Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm! Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comment. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. It is great to be with you once again. We have another great show in store for you today. And so let's take a look at what's on tap. We're going to talk about President Obama and what I'm calling the new Iraq war. I want to get your input. What do you think about us going back to that conflict? Also, Hillary Clinton has been on a book tour for the past several weeks, and is this good or bad for her presidency bid? If she wants to go and put her name in the hat, the things that happened over the book tour the past few weeks, is this a good thing for her or bad? We also want to take a look at something that's going on right now in North Carolina with respect to reparations. And there's a deadline coming up, so we need you really to tune in and reach out to the people that you may have out there in that part of the nation that could potentially go out there and help benefit from this particular situation. So, again, the deadline is tomorrow. We want to make sure we get you all to join in for that. And, of course, much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And now, to help me break all of this down, is the executive producer of Current Events and, of course, the chief operating officer of Current Events and the author of Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I introduce to some and present to others, no other than Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there's a lot going on I want to talk to with you about today. I mentioned Iraq War, Hillary Clinton's book tour, the eugenics board trying to pay reparations for what they did out in North Carolina, The split of the GOP, there's a few Supreme Court decisions. So we have a lot to discuss today. But first, I want to talk about two legends that passed away. And let's start with Bobby Womack, his passing and the significance he had on the entertainment community. What are your thoughts about him passing?
I absolutely adored Bobby Womack. He had some great signature songs, some that were remade by younger artists later on in his career. And it just seemed like Bobby Womack was always around, which I guess if he was 70 in my life, he was always around. But he was a pioneer as well. I mean, he had that, you know, that thing about him that did allow him to cross over into the next generation, into a younger generation. I know I put on Facebook, you know, that we should make sure Casey and JoJo from Jodeci is okay, because they really admired and looked up to Bobby Womack. And so, you know, there's not, you know, too many artists from back in the day that still has an impact on music and how good music is that. Not just music, but songs that you remember and you remember the words to. That's when you know it was a good song, that you can hear it today, 20 years, 30 years after it came out, and you still know the words to it. So that those are the type of songs that Bobby Womack put out.
Yeah, a lot of the music a couple of decades ago used to have that flavor to it. A lot of them was more classic music than the ones we hear today. What has changed in the music industry that enabled people to make classic music then, but not so much today?
Well, I think the industry became all about making money, and it didn't really it really is not filled with people who do it for the love of music. I mean, you have people now that'll do a song. I'm not even going to say an album. They'll do a song and think they have arrived, and if it was a hit, you may not even hear from them again. And so, you know, people back from the day, the Bobby Womacks of the world, Luthers and the OJs and the Temptations and Earth, Wind & Fire, those guys, you will beat the door down to go see them even in concert today, because you know you're going to get a show. You know you're going to get where there's a connection with where you are in, you know, in the audience and with that person performing. And I just think, you know, it became more about making money. And making money is fine. I mean, we know, you know, you look at the story, the fictional story of the Five Heartbeats, and which really wasn't that fictional. You know, it was true in terms of how they treated us. And but those guys did it for the love of music. They loved what they were doing. They knew that was their passion. They knew that's what they were called to do. And I don't think we have people nowadays where it's really their passion. I think it's their job. And because it's their job, they treat it like that. You know, they show up when they have to. They write when they have to. But if you're a true songwriter, if you're a true artist, it never leaves you. You're always... there's always a song on the inside of you. Words that will come out, they're always there. And so I think that's what's missing.
Yeah, you know, I have to agree with you on that. So I want to talk about another person that has passed, that has left us, and that's actor Meshach Taylor. He's best known for his role as in Designing Women and for his part in Mannequin. He passed away, and what do you think about his passing? We're losing some icons here.
We are, and I, you know, he was such a breath of fresh air for me on Designing Women. Just his character and how he managed those women in his own way, and it's weird because just recently, I was watching, I believe, an episode of Criminal Minds. Now, I don't watch Criminal Minds as much as I used to because it comes on Wednesdays and I'm usually at church. But, and I don't know if this was a new episode or maybe something within the last year, but he was on Criminal Minds and he was playing a homeless veteran. and that, you know, was an alcoholic and was down on his luck and things of that nature. And one of the characters from Criminal Minds was remembered him. They served together in the war, Vietnam. So it was interesting that I had just seen him. For me, I just seen him in this episode of Criminal Minds. And I was like, well, I wonder, you know, what he's been up to. You know, I hadn't seen him in a while. And so just to see him in that time and then a week later, to see the post on Facebook or it was on Twitter that he was sick and the family was asking everyone to pray just yesterday, or Friday evening, early yesterday morning, that came across Facebook and Twitter. And then, you know, and then for him to pass, it was like, wow, you know. I'm wondering if that was his last role, was that one he did on Criminal Minds.
Yeah, perhaps so. So, you know, I just wanted to take a moment to kind of pay homage to two, I think, icons in our entertainment community. And so, you know, of course, our prayers and thoughts go out to their families. And during this time, I know you write about this in your book about this kind of part of a person's life and what they have to go through. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
And what you deal with in death?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it is a process, and it's not, you know, something that you ever get used to. I don't care how many times it happens, and, you know, there's several times in our life that people leave us, and one chapter on day four is entitled When Death Comes Calling. And, you know, whether you're prepared or you're not prepared, the person dies suddenly, they've been sick for a while, it doesn't matter. When the final breath is taken and that person you know is no longer with you in the flesh, you have nothing more to rely on but your faith and to get you through your moment of grief. And even in grieving someone who may not have treated you the best, it still is a loss. And we have to understand that all of our losses that we experience will require us to grieve it. Now, we can ignore that and try to act like we're not bothered by the loss, but we really are. And so we'll mask it and cover it up with so many other things until we no longer can do it, and we're forced to deal with that loss. And so even the loss of someone who wasn't kind to you, to someone that mistreated you, even when they leave, whether it's physically, you know, they leave you because they died, or, you know, they leave you because they walk away from you, you still need to recognize that you're going to go through some sort of grieving period of the loss of that relationship. And we just have to learn how to better prepare ourselves for it, because we don't do a good enough job, in my opinion, a well enough job, in my opinion, when it comes to preparing ourselves for the end. We do a lot about right now, and not just the preparing in terms of the cost of the burial or the funeral, but just your mind emotionally. What are you going to feel like that day you wake up and that person you cannot call because they're not going to answer? You know, how do you prepare your mind to start thinking like that? And so we have to know that, you know, everything comes to an end. And when it does, we just got to give ourselves permission to grieve that. And so, you know, we all, these last 30 days or so, we've seen, you know, a lot of people leave us that we didn't think were going to be gone already. I mean, you just mentioned two with Bobby Womack and Meshach Taylor, but we, you know, we in the same 30-day period, you know, there's been Ruby Dee, there's been Maya Angelou. I mean, there's been. And so, and you're wondering, you know, who else? Who's next? You know, who's next? And so we have to just prepare ourselves for those times and do a better job of getting ourselves ready and recognizing that we grieve in different stages and we all grieve in different ways. And there's no right or wrong way to go through that process.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. So, you know, again, I think you did a really good job, going through these things in your book. And for those of you out there listening in and want to get the book, again, you can get it at TaylorMade101.com/reflections. That's TaylorMade101.com/reflections. So I want to shift now to a lighter story. One, since we were off last week, I was celebrating my 45th birthday. Woo-hoo. And very proud of that number. 45 is a blessing now today when you look at the numbers of African-Americans that are incarcerated, the ones that are dead, especially in my generation, the X's. So, it's truly a blessing to be still here at 45 and still have to be in my right mind and body and soul. So I'm pretty excited about that. But we were off last week, and so we didn't get a chance to talk about Kevin Hart and the fact that he donated $50,000 to Texas Southern University's marching band. And I posted a blog out there about this because I wanted to say it's pretty awesome that he did that. Primarily because we hear so much about HBCUs being in financial trouble. And we know that most of the ones that go to majority schools, they have a strong alumni, and it's supported by, the sports and athletics. But they do have a strong alumni, and you hear about a lot of the donations that are going on. So when you look at the fact that he donated $50,000 to Texas Southern University, an HBCU, and even though it's going to the marching band, I think it's a step in the right direction when it comes to supporting our schools. And, even if I posted it here, I said that, I often say a vision without finances is just a hallucination. And so in order for us to continue to be able to do things we want to do in our communities, we need money. And so for him to take this step, I thought was an amazing thing to do. And I also want to say the second part of that, if you have people that graduated from the university, if they just donated a fraction of that number, we would have some strength in our schools. What do you think about what he did?
I think it's to be commended, and the fact that A, he did it is to be commended, and B, he earmarked it for the band department is another because we know there's sometimes our HBCUs, although we love to see them perform, as you stated, we're not giving them the support they need to get to these places to perform. And, or their equipment isn't quite up to par, or their practice facilities isn't quite up to standard. And so we have to do a better job of supporting our HBCUs, not just with lip service, especially those that went to and graduated from, even if you didn't graduate from, you still need to support it. And then those that graduated from should support the HBCUs as well, because they are needed, and we know, a lot is being done to decrease funding, and so we have to make sure that we don't lose any more of our schools because of lack of funding.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So, again, my hat's off to Kevin Hart for donating $50,000 to Texas Southern University. So I'm going to take a quick break, and when we return, I want to get into some real hardcore stuff, right? I want to talk about the Iraq War, specifically when it comes to looking at the dichotomy or the challenges that we face today. On the one hand, you have United States or the Republican Party, I should say, always wanting to go to war. And then on the other hand, you have majority of the American people, especially the soldiers, going through what I'm going to call battle fatigue or combat fatigue. Battle fatigue is a term that we use in the military when you've been in combat for so long, you start to get kind of worn out by this whole notion of fighting and just war. And so I think America is really getting to a position where they're getting to be kind of combat or battle fatigue as well. So we're going to address that when I come back. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Kind of Friends with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, current events, and Ask Gema can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Gema. And Ask Gema says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me. Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So I want to get now down to the nitty-gritty, down to what's happening here in what I'm calling the new Iraq war. And the reason why I say it's the new Iraq war, because most people can put their hand on why we went to the conflict in 1991. And primarily, I was a part of that conflict. I actually led the 2nd Army Cavalry Regiment in Benelux, Germany, in their efforts to fire some of the first rounds, artillery rounds, into Iraq when we did that conflict. And, of course, you know, after the air campaign, you know, we went in, the ground forces went in, and we kind of wrapped that conflict up within a short period of time. Several years later, and that first conflict was primarily associated with them, you know, moving into Kuwait. And then, you know, when we went in several years later, you know, Bush, you know, kind of went in and was looking for weapons of mass destruction. He kind of coupled that to the towers being coming down, and people argued that the main reason for us going over there was kind of twofold. One, because of what happened when Bush 1 was there. And then two, they say Bush 2 went in because of the fact that, you know, they wanted that oil, and it had to do with Halliburton. So, you know, there's a couple of, but people can primarily put their hand on a reason to go out there in that conflict. But this time, not so much. You know, we've been over there. We keep changing sides, it seems like. So Gema, on the one hand, you have Republicans, you know, want to always be in some kind of conflict, right? That's how they grease their pumps. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, the American military pretty much in a situation where they've kind of been taxed out. You know, you fight this long and you have this many injuries, especially for not a real cause that you can put your hand on, you know. So what do you think is happening here, Gene, with this conflict?
Well, here's the deal. I think this is for sure a time where we can sit down and have a seat. there has to come a point when those people there will have to stand up and fight their own battles. We cannot continue to go in and be the savior of the world. We have way too many issues here in the United States of America, on these shores, from sea to shining sea. We have way too many issues. Our unemployment rate is still too high. Our poverty rate is still too high. The gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy is way too massive. We have too many kids who cannot read at grade level. Our education system needs to be revamped. We have bridges all around this country that need to be rebuilt. And we keep going places, rebuilding other places when our house is crumbling. And so, there's an old song, old to this, says there's a leak in this old building. Well, we got a leak in our building here in the United States. And we need to hurry up and figure out how we're going to manage this leak. Because eventually, if it keeps leaking, and things are not going to get any better for us. So we don't need to continue to go. I mean, we went in, we did some stuff, we didn't have no business, and we were sold a bill of goods. We were going to be liberators, they were going to love us. Well, I don't think we ever got to that stage of the relationship, but maybe we did and I missed it. But we're in a season now, we're in another time, and the decisions that President Obama and his administration have to make cannot be made based on the decisions of how Bush did it and his administration. As Reverend Al often talks about, we're at the Jordan. We're not at the Red Sea. So we needed Moses at the Red Sea, and we need Joshua now. So we can't employ the same tactics at the Jordan that we did at the Red Sea. You got to do something different. And so, we have got to do something different as it relates to how we manage all of our foreign affairs and all the people, because like you said, we didn't change sides. Now we back on the side. I don't even know whose side we on. And if it can't be explained to me as a layperson who has to contend with the fallout, because we, the people, have to contend with the fallout in terms of our men and women that come back not who they were when they left, we have to contend with that. So if you want me to have to battle that, then you need to give me what I need so I can understand why we think we need to go. I'm not convinced that that's where we need to be right now.
It was interesting is the fact that you mentioned several issues with respect to policies that we need to address in the United States. When you made reference to the leaking building, i.e. the bridges need repairing, the school system is taking a turn for the worse. Crime rates are at all-time highs. Unemployment rates at all-time highs. So when you look at those issues and you look at the fact that the people that we have in office now in the House and Representative as well as the Senate, do they have the capacity to get any of these things done? I mean, we've now experienced them for several years, six or more years. And I have seen nothing come out of that remotely just even looks like anything that's going to provide some benefit to our society. So the question then is, do they have the capacity to do anything good for the United States?
When you're a manager, supervisor, whatever, over people, you as a trainer, you look to see whether or not what you're dealing with is whether or not it's ability or whether or not it's willingness. And so based on which one of those you come up with determines what your next level of intervention would be. So do they have the ability? Yes. So that means it's not a training issue. It's nothing that I can fix. It's nothing I can give them that will help them do their job. They have the ability to do it. This is a willingness issue. So usually when you're dealing with the willingness issue of a person and that person is an employee of yours, you have graduated sanctions for what you do with them. You give them a reprimand. You give them a verbal warning. You tell them what's going to happen next. Well, I think they're at the point of, we've told you what's going to happen if you fail to come up with a job skill. And until we start talking in that type of language, the next step is that they have to be voted out because they don't have a willingness to serve. Being in an elected official is not just about the position. You are in a position to serve the people whom elected you. And what are you doing to serve me that will have an impact on my life or my child's life or my community's life? And so if you're not willing to serve in your position, then you don't need to be in that position. I may be fine in my neighborhood. My community may be fine. My school may be fine. But if you are a representative in the House in D.C. or a senator, that means you ran a statewide election, and that means you're speaking for the whole state. You're no longer just speaking for your district as a senator. You're speaking for the whole state. So that means you need to talk, policies and bills that you bring forth should be about impacting the whole. And that's what they're not doing. They're not even impacting in the House. They're not even impacting their district. They're not impacting anywhere. And so it's a willingness issue. And so they need to go, all of them. If you haven't put forth a bill that's going to be about bringing back jobs, that's going to be about helping the least of these, our children, and education, and making sure they're fed, making sure that they have health care that's affordable. If that's not what you're up there doing in Washington, then you're not serving the people. And so you need to go.
Yeah, I have to agree with you.
It's real simple.
So what's interesting is that when you look at the fact that the senators and the House of Representatives, they're not really doing anything. You know, they're legislators. They're now making laws that's going to provide any kind of benefit to the society at large. So, and so the president goes out and he tries to, invoke action that at least under his power, under his purview, he could actually get things done. And then lo and behold, this stunt by John Boehner said he's going to sue the president. So what do you make of John Boehner's dramatics about trying to sue the president for him trying to make sure that things are getting done since obviously the legislature's not doing
it? Well, here's the thing about John Boehner. You know, he's holding on to his job by the hair on his chinny chin chin. And so he's trying to do whatever he can. They say in the media to throw some red meat to the base. And everybody don't really quite know what to do with their base, because I don't even know if they realize who their base is at this point. So you have the upset of Eric Cantor in Virginia, and then you have the demise of McDaniels down in Mississippi. And so I know we're going to talk about this. The Republican Party is in some sort of days right now, and then you have this man who's the leader of the House to come out and say he's going to sue the president for what? What exactly are you going to sue the president for? And instead of our mainstream media on any side challenging him on that statement alone, because you don't come out and say I'm going to sue you, and then you can't tell me what you're suing me for. You're not getting back with me on suing me. You didn't tell me what you're going to sue me for. And somebody in that room should have had enough gumption in them to ask the hard question. What are you trying to sue the president for? And what is your proof that this is something that he's done that requires you to bring a suit? And who's supporting you in this nonsense? Because we want to talk to them too. Who are the people in your party here in D.C. that support you in quote-unquote suing the president of the United States for what?
Yeah, on the one hand, you have Congress acting like this, and then on the other hand, you have the media not holding the people accountable for that. And so you got now these two supposed to be responsible parties not getting anything done. So this kind of explains why we're in so much turmoil.
It does explain why we're in so much turmoil, because they're not doing anything. The things that they're doing has no impact on my day-to-day life. The amount of times they chose to try to repeal affordable health care did what to me on a day-to-day basis? It costs us money, but we keep saying we don't have money to fund education and to fund early childhood education and to fund feeding our children in both urban and rural America. You know, we don't have the money to fund health care, but we have money to spend and burn and waste on trying to pass a law to repeal it. When the Supreme Court, the highest office of the land, then told you that it's the law. It's nothing. It's not unconstitutional. But yet we still want to talk about it. That I don't get that. And I don't know why they are allowed to continue to. I mean, we the people ought to be filing suit against Congress for dereliction of duty. They haven't done their job.
Yeah, so that begs the question then. That begs the question then, what can the American people do, right? So, I mean,
that's what we need to do. Somebody, one of these ACLU, Poverty Center people, that's what they go out. Somebody need to put a fire under them that speaks on behalf of the United States of America that we the people are suing Congress. Somebody need to get on TV and start saying it.
So that's
definitely
an action that we can take. If you can sue the president, that means we can sue you, or we can sue Congress.
We can sue you. That's right.
Because
it's an easy
case to make because you can sue him for negligence, right? A dereliction
of
duty. All of those things can be the case because we just listed a number of things that they're not attending to, and you know, and then again, as we talk about all the time, where's the jobs bill? You know, I mean, that alone, what they ran on several years ago, they still haven't put forth a jobs bill. So, I mean, that alone should be dereliction of duty, or at least cause for a lawsuit if you want to talk about suing somebody.
Exactly, and yet he gets to get on television and always talk about the president is not listening to the American people. The American people voted for the president twice. I think the president and the American people are on the same page.
Right.
It's the other people that's not listening to what the American people want. We voted for the person who said they could do A, B, and C, and here you are not allowing him to do A, B, and C. So why are you still there? That's the bigger question. And the thing that kills me or that irritates me, that bothers my soul sometimes, is that we allow them to stay in their district. And we don't even put nobody up against them. When John Boehner ran in 2012, he'd have no opposition from one Democrat. Why? Because his district is so red that he couldn't possibly, would nobody possibly win. But that's what they started out in Mississippi, and look what happened.
Exactly. So the other thing I was going to say was that, we talked about Congress and their culpability in not getting anything done. And the second thing we mentioned was the fact that the media also has some responsibility by not challenging them or by not asking the right questions or not pressing the issue rather than just letting things slide and making comments like it's not my job to ask them the second question, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, I think another action the American people can take, of course, is to say, hey, we're going to turn off the TV because that's directly tied to how they get paid, right? I mean, when we look several years ago at the bus boycott, right, it was so effective, not because people, didn't ride the bus, but it was so effective because it affected the bottom line. And so when you start talking about affecting the bottom line, whether it be through just turning off the TV or going to alternate sources for information and you express why you're doing that, then it begins to make the people do the right thing. But as long as we are the people are allowing the media to treat us in such a way, as long as we are allowing Congress to get away with, you know, the ludicrosity that they do every day, then they're going to continue to do that. Why change anything because they're not being held accountable? You know, I talk about the Dallas Cowboys all the time, the fact that Jerry Jones has no incentive to do anything different. He has no incentive to go out and get anybody because his fans are going to be there no matter what, right? He's going to sell out that stadium every time. So if he's looking at his bottom line, he doesn't have to worry about a victory or worry about a championship as long as he's making money. You know, until people stop visiting the stadium, until people stop saying, I'm not going to patronize the Cowboys, I'm not going to buy their uniforms until you get team members that are going to help us win, then, what incentive does he have to do anything different? Congress is in the same position. The media is in the same position. As long as we, the people, the one that really has the power, because we pay their bills. And until we understand that completely, they're going to continue to act and behave in that way.
That's exactly right. Until we the people really realize what kind of power we really have, then this is what we're going to be dealt with. We're going to continue to sit here and hold these thoughts and feelings that we have and think that there's nothing we can do. But we only have history to guide us on the fact that we know that there's something we can do. History has already shown us that there's something we can do. We just got to be willing to do it. We have to be willing to make the sacrifice. See, what we don't want to do is sacrifice. We don't want to give up nothing, you know. So you talked about the Montgomery Bus boycott, and that was a sacrifice because they had to walk. If they wanted to be sure that they were going to be treated equally on a bus, a public transportation, and not be asked to give up their seat to go to the back because they were black and the person getting on was white and there weren't any more seats anywhere, then they had to give up their seat. If they wanted to be respected and treated with dignity, then they had to sacrifice, and they did. They walked in the rain. They walked in the snow. They walked when it was hot. They walked when it was muggy outside. They walked when it was cloudy and when the sun was shining bright. They walked. They sacrificed to make it happen. I don't see us wanting to sacrifice. I don't see us having the tenacity, the stick-to-itness to do anything for over a period of time. I just don't see it. They sacrificed over a year on that boycott. We go down and do one rally, and we think the world is going to change. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, this reminds me, you know, as we are celebrating the 50 years after Freedom Summer and what happened in Mississippi over the past couple of weeks with respect to the vote. So it's interesting to see how the stick-to-itness that they had, the tenacity that they had back then, and you see the results today. I mean, because of the people, you know, sitting in and teaching them, going to the polls and losing their lives and fighting every day, we are able to enjoy and experience the democracy that's really is supposed to be afforded to everybody. You know, so we're now starting to experience that. And so here we are 50 years later, and you see the fact that the black vote, if you will, enabled one of the, you know, crazy people not to get in office, right? One of the Tea Party members not to get in office. So it is so befitting that this time of year that we were able to experience that. But just to kind of circle back, the fact that, you know, we need that kind of tenacity today. If we're going to get anything done, if we really want anything done in our society, we need to get back to that type of root. We need to get back to the bus boycott type of mentality, because if we don't do that, we'll continue to have this conversation, you know, when the president is gone, when the next president is in, and so forth.
That is for sure. I mean, we're gonna find ourselves in a serious situation, and we're gonna wake up and try to figure out how we got here. Well, we got here because we wasn't paying attention, and we allowed these state houses to take us back to such a time where we was not even considered to be human. So you know, there you have it. So we can play like all is well, and racism doesn't exist anymore, and people, everybody has the same access, and everybody has the same. We can play like all of that is true, but that's not the reality. You know, yes. I can play like, you know, I wear a size 2, but when I go in the store and try to put on a size 2, that's not the reality. I'm not a size 2, and there's nothing a 2 gonna do for me at that moment. And so that's where we are. We are living in an altered state of consciousness. We don't see things for what they really are. We have this make-believe idea that one day those people up there watching are going to wake up and do what we know they know how to do. And they haven't done it in 4 years. When that Congress got into power, they haven't done anything in 4 years. And we're still thinking they are. Shame on us. we need to vote them out.
Period. Yeah, I have to agree with you. That you know, we have to vote them out unless, of course, they split themselves and they vote each other out, which is looks like is the case nowadays. There's a lot of talk recently from the Tea Party splitting off from the GOP. What do you think about that?
I think it's an excellent idea because here's the deal. The Tea Party is the Republican Party. I've said this from the very beginning. I have yet to see on a voting ballot Tea Party. I haven't seen it. I vote in every election that's in my city, in my state. I'm not missing this. And I have yet to see a candidate's name, and then it has Tea Party. I haven't seen that. It might have TP in parentheses, but it's still listed under Republican. So we have two parties, Republican Party, and we have the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party, you have a section of them that feel as though they should have more power than they do. They seem to not like people that don't look like them. They seem to not like government to be involved in business unless it has to do with somebody else's business. By that, I mean you don't want government involved in, health care or regulations, the EPA or Food Administration, but you want the government to decide whether or not I can have an abortion, have the conversation about it, what kind of contraception I should be able to use, whether or not, as a woman, my body is mine to make decisions on. You want government there, but you don't want government to help me feed the child that you just told me I had to have. That confuses me. That just confuses me. And so, you know, I say they need to be split. And then you deal. But then again, they need to go on and stay together, because the more they stay together and all the infighting they have going on, if Democrats are smart, they use this. I'm hoping there's some real strategist out there. Whoever was the strategic person for the first Obama campaign, I hope they are consulting with old girl Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC chair, and showing her how to manage this. Because the Democrats can manage this. Liberals can manage this if they do it right.
Yeah,
it can be
absolutely
managed and could come out on top. But if they don't manage it and take advantage of it, it's going to be, as you stated the other week, another missed opportunity.
Yeah. So, and for those of the listeners that may not be aware of this line of conversation, there's a good article in The Root, theroot.com, that is entitled "Don't Bet Against a Right-Wing Third Party in 2016." And it says, "Don't say I didn't tell you. 2 years from now, the GOP will officially split into two parties, with traditional Republicans getting freed up to do their thing while a more robust Tea Party spinoff picks its own nominee for a presidential election that will be unlike any we've seen since Ross Perot's wild ride in 1992. As political predictions go, it's out there, I know, but a confluence of trends, including the public's anxiety, right-wing nuttiness, and incentives from rhinos, which are Republicans in name only, and Tea Partiers to go their separate ways, are contributing to what will become one of the most politically cataclysmic presidential races ever." And so I think the rationale is twofold for splitting off. One was people can go off into their own little worlds and, you know, and like minds, you know, get off of the Rush Limbaughs and all, and his party basically can go off into their own little world and talk as crazy as one can do. I mean, and then because they have so many low information voters that listen to and cater to and support that kind of ideology, then they can raise all kind of money. And so when they get that kind of money, of course, the game is the short game, not the long game. And what I mean by short game, I mean by, you know, to run, they're not going to get the nominee. A nomination, but they can raise all this money and make tons of it during the primaries. And so, you know, it's a primary game. It's a short game to raise money from low-information voters to really do that. And when it comes to being a mainstream candidate and you have to move to the center because you now have to get votes from the left and the right to hold the highest office, then their whole strategy falls apart. So, you know, I can understand this happening, again, for two reasons. One, because I think it allowed them to get off into their own little corner and hold temper tantrums all day long. And then two, to be able to raise money in the primary races and you know, and to try to make a mark. And then when they get ready to go to be the nominee, then they can kind of fall off the face of the earth. I mean, Sarah Palin really championed that model. And the reason why she probably won't run again for the office, but she will probably get out there and become a force because of the money. The money, especially with the new laws. And so it's going to be interesting to see this really take fold over the next couple of years because the Supreme Court has opened the doors for this kind of madness, right? The madness of let's split off. I can now support anybody in the United States in any district because there are no limits now, and so and then you couple that with the fact that you know they have all these you know vehicles to get all this crazy information out. So it's going to be interesting to see what takes fold. So what do you think the worst thing could happen, Jima, and then what's the best case base thing can happen with this split?
Well, the worst thing could happen is that come 2014, in this midterm election, that we don't go out and vote and we allow them to gain control of the Senate. Because then nothing will get done and the president's last 2 years will, I mean, I wouldn't even be able to call him a lame duck. I don't know what he would be called at that point because there nothing would happen. So that's the worst thing that could happen is that we don't go out and vote. The best thing can happen is that they split or not, and we still go out and vote, and we vote our interests, and we vote what's important to us, and we vote, and in doing so, those types of people with those, you know, hardcore lines of ideology won't be allowed to be sitting in a seat where you're making decisions for the world, for the United States. You won't get there. So you can have that thought process in your little bubble in your own little private world. But we're not going to let you come into the big world and corrupt it and create such chaos. And so the worst case, we don't vote and more of them get in Congress and more of them are there to be obstructionists. Best case, we go vote whether they split or not. We vote, and which means if we go vote, we can vote some of the ones that they're out. Thus limiting.
Yes,
right. Thus limiting, you know, their power of reach. Even more. So that's best and that's worst.
So I want to talk a little bit now about, since we're on this topic of the presidential election, presidential race and talking about the president, what do you make of Hillary Clinton, A, her bid for the White House, and then B, the fact that she's went on this book tour for the last several weeks, and what kind of impact did the book tour have on her potentially putting her name in the hat for to become president?
Okay, let me just say I am not on Team Hillary. It's not that I don't think she's qualified to do the job. It's not that, you know, whatever. I find it hard to stomach that normally the person who succeeds in running, if they so choose, is the person that's sitting in the second seat, and that's the vice president. And for some reason, we have just dismissed Vice President Biden, and that bothers me. And because it bothers me, I give less than a hoot about Hillary because I just think that's completely disrespectful. It's like I'm at the lunch counter, and I've been standing there for 5 minutes, and yet, little Susie over here comes up with her little blonde hair twingling, and you go ask her what she wants. But I've been here, and you ain't asked me nothing. So I got a problem with that. So, aside from my own personal feelings about that, back, you know, to your real question. If Hillary decides to run, I think this type of exposure has been good because it gives her time to work out all the kinks of, you know, those moments when she says things and she has to go back and clarify it five times, and Bill has to come on and say something three times to get everybody on the same page. And so this gives her time to kind of work all that out. It gives people time to read the book and have all the questions they want to have about it. And so that if she decides to run, you know, you can't throw up a whole lot in her face because she's kind of put it out there already. That's not to say that they won't. It's not to say they won't bring up old stuff, you know, back to when he was president. But it does her one service of being able to address things head on. And on another thing, it shows her flaws and it shows her vulnerabilities and it shows the areas in which she might be considered a weak candidate in. And so if you're testing out the waters, this is a good place to test it out on. It's still an election time, so people are listening to what's going on in the news because we are in midterm elections are coming up and we've got primaries. So people are paying attention. And so whatever is sticking to the wall from her interviews and sit-downs and book reviews and things of that nature is sticking to the wall because people are paying attention because of the season that we're in. So she has to make the decision whether or not she's going to continue to go down this path. And once she makes it clear whether or not she's going to run, then she can expect a whole other set of issues because they're going to come up. But I'm just not convinced that she's our best candidate. I'm just not convinced of that. And as I stated, I just find it completely disrespectful to discount Joe Biden. I just have a problem with that.
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, a lot of people that were in Hillary Clinton's court are now, you know, reassessing that. It is an interesting article in the Huffington Post by an author named Catherine, I want to say, Taibbi. And it talks about Andrea Mitchell's assessment of what Hillary Clinton has done over the past couple of weeks. In fact, she was on Meet the Press, and she told David Gregory that Clinton is rusty and out of touch. To judge by recent comments the former Secretary of State made during her book tour. And she's a little bit out of touch, Mitchell said, despite all of her work and all of her connections to hardworking people in the middle class. Mitchell's criticism is a response to recent comments Clinton made to Diane Sawyer that her family was dead broke when they left the White House in 2000. These remarks have made Clinton the target of tough media criticism. So, Jim, what do you make of her, A, Andrea Mitchell's comments, and then B, the fact that Hillary Clinton says she was broke?
Well, here's the thing. You know, a piece of me, I understand what Andrea Mitchell is saying. It's just interesting to me that she has all these insights for other people, but when she's sitting there interviewing people herself, she don't ask the tough questions either. So I'm not real sure how she can judge anybody. But I think, you know, yeah. I think Hillary may be, I don't necessarily know if she's rusty. I mean, she just hasn't been, I mean, she's been in public service the majority of her life, and that's just not, you don't lose that. I mean, you know, I haven't, you know, worked in, I haven't done a formalized training in 6 months or more, over a year, but that don't mean when I get up to train, I ain't going to remember what to do. It's like riding a bike. I know how to do that. Things you know how to do, you know how to do. You're not going to forget them. So, you know, her comments might be a little off, but I think they're only off because we're living in a 24-hour news cycle. Okay, so if she said they was broke, define broke back in the 90s when they left office. What were we dealing with back then? And we can't gauge her on the fact that they've made millions now over the course of those, what, almost 20 years they've been gone out of the White House?
Right.
So they've done a lot. I mean, if they ain't came up by now, I wouldn't want her to be the president no way, because you ain't got no vision. You don't know how to pick yourself up and keep it moving. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want her to be my president. So I'm hoping that they were able to take where they were, come up with a plan and move themselves forward to be in the position that they're in now. That's the American story, you know, isn't it? To take your situation, whether it's the lump of coal or the bricks, you know, whatever you were given, and build something with it. And that's what she's done. So, you know, maybe she didn't need to say she was flat broke, because maybe people have a hard time believing that they were flat broke. But the reports, you know, say that they didn't, leaving out the day they left, not what happened the next day. But because we live in the 24-hour news cycle, everything is parceled right then, right there, and at that moment. And so we don't give it time to marinate and think about it. We're already jumping, trying to figure out what's wrong about what the person just said. And so because of that, you know, maybe saying they were flat broke, when people who are really, who live paycheck to paycheck, cannot visualize the Clintons ever being flat broke because of where they are today. But that's not fair. That's not fair.
Right. All right, we're up against the break. When we return, we're going to have our Black Acre Policy segment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Seema, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Obama has selected Bob McDonald, a former Procter & Gamble CEO, to be the new head of the embattled Department of Veterans Affairs. A White House official says the president will nominate McDonald tomorrow. If the 61-year-old, who's a graduate of West Point, is confirmed by the Senate, he would succeed Eric Shinseki, who resigned in May. The extremist group that's taken over much of Iraq has announced the creation of an Islamic State. NPR's Alice Fordham reports the statement is a challenge to the Al-Qaeda command structure.
It is a dream that lives in the depths hopes of every Muslim believer, says the statement. It is a hope that flutters in the heart of every brave monotheist. That dream is the caliphate, a restored Islamic state governed by a religious leader called a caliph. The announcement is made by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS, who are changing their name just to the Islamic State. They say it's because they now rule over all Muslims worldwide who must now vow loyalty. Analysts see the statement as a challenge by the group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to al-Qaeda's leadership, who have disowned him. Alice Borden, NPR News, Baghdad.
The White House is set to request more than $2 billion from Congress to help deal with an influx of Central American immigrants. NPR's Sam Sanders reports the administration will also ask Congress to make it easier to send some of those immigrants back to their home countries.
The administration will ask for greater flexibility in processing and quickly removing unaccompanied minors who have crossed the border illegally and come from countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Under current law, unaccompanied child immigrants from Mexico can be sent back directly, but children from other South American countries are released to family members in the states or put in foster care while they wait for immigration court. The administration may also ask for more immigration judges and stiffer penalties for those who smuggle children across the border. So far this year, Customs and Border Patrol has apprehended over 50,000 unaccompanied minors. That's a 100% increase from last year. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
Firefighters continue to battle a wildfire in Arizona's White Mountains. Pamela Baltimore is a National Forest spokeswoman. She says they're taking advantage of calmer winds to build containment lines around the fire.
There have been predicted gusts up to 10 miles an hour today, which was similar to yesterday, and the outlook looks great.
And Liza Simmons, a public information officer on the San Juan fire, says firefighters are doing a burnout, deliberately setting fires to help with containment.
There are certain areas that are looking good because of the burnouts that they've done and the dozer lines and hand lines that they've put in.
It's still around 8 square miles and just under 40 homes remain evacuated. The World Cup continues in Brazil today. Right now, Costa Rica is playing Greece. Earlier, the Netherlands scored late, beating Mexico 2-1 on penalty. This is NPR. Suspected Islamist extremists sprayed gunfire at worshippers in northern Nigeria, torching four churches in a village that's just miles from the town where more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped by the extremist group Boko Haram. Witnesses say several people were killed and survivors are in hiding. Boko Haram are demanding the release of detained fighters in return for the girls who were kidnapped in April. The extremists are blamed for last week's bombing of a shopping mall in Abuja, the capital of central Nigeria, that killed 24 people. Black Entertainment Television holds its annual awards show tonight, celebrating African-American artists in show business. As NPR's Neda Ulibi reports, the show, which will be hosted by comedian Chris Rock, has recently earned particularly strong ratings for the network.
For the past 2 years, the BET Awards have been the most watched award show on cable television, at least for adults aged 18 to 49. Last year's BET Awards was the most watched show that Sunday evening, period, in spite of headliners who faced allegations of treating women violently, namely Chris Brown and R. Kelly. More than 7 million people tuned in. The show's made a point of emphasizing performances over drawn-out awards announcements. This year, Beyoncé, Jay-Z, and John Legend are scheduled to perform, as well as Lionel Richie, who will be recognized for his lifetime achievements. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
Misak Taylor has died. The actor best known for playing the role of Anthony on the 1980 sitcom Designing Women. He also was in the movie Mannequin and Damien, Omen 2. His agent says he died yesterday at his home near Los Angeles after a battle with cancer. He was 67. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
It's time for Blackacre Policy Forum, a progressive think tank founded by Leo Baron Hicks, a place where a new dialogue concerning public policy can find innovative strategies and bold solutions. Welcome to Blackacre Policy Forum.
I'm able to see clearly. clear the right. Cause Lewis they slide them or improve the light. And J.A. Burr invented the lawnmower. Let me expand the mind of all you young soldiers. Sarah Boone invented the...
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. As you heard, it's now time for our Black Acre Policy Forum segment. And I encourage all the listeners every week to go out and check out this blog. I mean, it is totally awesome. And that's blackacrepolicyforum.org. That's BLACKACRE Policy Forum. All one word, blackacrepolicyforum.org. And today, a segment posted by Leo Baron Hicks is entitled, To Merely Survive. Now, quite naturally, we're going to have Leo join us here momentarily, but I would like to just take a few moments to kind of go through the blog and then have a brief discussion about the blog. But I want to give listeners an opportunity to call in. Again, the number to call is 323-580-5712. To Merely Survive. Just the other day, a colleague and dear friend of mine, Mr. Jefferson, and I were having a heart-to-heart conversation. He advised me that his air conditioner recently broken had to be either replaced or repaired. The unit was not under warranty, and the scorch of a Texas summer makes air conditioning an absolute must. During our conversation, Mr. Jefferson stated that the repair or replacement would cost money he did not have and that the situation had caused friction between him and his wife. More significantly, he shared how he had grown weary, so very tired of always struggling, of barely surviving. While I sympathize with his plight and shared one of my two of my own, I do not worry about Mr. Jefferson. The brother is intelligent, hardworking, and a good provider. He is blessed with a good wife and a strong family who love him. Moreover, he is one of the sharpest men I know. In a world of players and pimps, gangsters and thugs, this is a good man who will prevail no matter the difficulty, regardless the circumstances. But the conversation raises a number of important questions for and about our community. One of the things of which we are most proud is our ability to survive the worst that life has to offer. We are still here despite of, or perhaps because of, all we have endured, including but not limited to the transatlantic slave trade, the inhumanity of slavery and the ethnic terrorism thereafter, the civil rights movement, the war on drugs, come the wars on us, and the more insidious travesty of black-on-black crime and gun violence. Ours is truly a unique voyage. The survival instinct has been so internalized by African Americans as to be a part of our DNA. To endure, to carry on is our theme, our focus, our very purpose. In other words, survive is not what we do. To survive is who we are. But while survival is absolutely essential, it is mere survival enough? We think not. A persuasive argument can be made that to barely survive is wholly inadequate. For one thing, mere survival breeds complacency. It is the rusty nail that allows us to complain and only complain sans any effort to improve our circumstances. It is the false sense of security and the unwarranted feeling of accomplishment. It is the unconditional surrender to the status quo, the habit of settling for and otherwise tolerating that which we abhor rather than pursuing that which we deserve. Consider, for example, how many of us hate our jobs, I mean really despise them, yet we remain in positions that devalue us by engaging in a pattern of inane rationalizations, false equivalencies, and faulty comparisons. I'm blessed to have a job, we reason, or at least I'm not doing as badly as they we believe, the accuracy of which is beside the point. To have a stable source of income while so many others are unemployed is indeed reason to feel blessed. And no one wants to be at the bottom of the pile. Yet, a horrible job is still a horrible job and therefore provides no reason to be complacent, nor does it obviate the responsibility of finding a more fulfilling way of earning a living. And it matters not that someone else's position is worse than ours. The standard of comparison is not the nadir about the apex. In other words, if we must make comparisons, it should be to those who are doing well rather than those who are not doing so well. In addition, bare survival is an opiate as addictive as any street drug. It hooks us, making us fiend for just another hit of always struggling yet never advancing. It is a blindfold which blocks and distorts our vision, blinding us to greater possibilities. To merely survive causes us to focus on the pavement rather than to marvel at the heavens. Less than an attitude and more than a condition, naked survival is a position, a location that places us behind the eight ball rather than near the finish line. It is the trap of life, scarring denials and unfulfilled dreams. It is a prison of chains around our hands and feet, shackles that stretch from the present generation to the past, the last to the first. To barely survive is a penitentiary which locks us up and straps us down, a cell block of despondency and cage of despair. And worst, bare survival does more than prevent us from achieving. It is a cruel and unrepentant thief who steals our hopes and dreams. It so tries, tires, and frustrates us, so depletes our physical and emotional and intellectual resources that we have nothing left to give. All we can manage is to survive, just barely, if that. This is a real and material difference between surviving and thriving, between existing and prospering. And while basic survival is good and necessary, it is little to brag about. Hence, to merely survive is a cruel illusion. One either moves forward or slowly but inexorably dies. In conclusion, we stand on the cusp of a great decision, whether to continue as we have or to make fundamental changes in our attitude and the way we approach life. Any passage, all crossing, no matter the distance, regardless of the destination, notwithstanding the traveler, is fraught with peril. This is particularly true of family, for which the trail of years has been populated by hardships every step of the way. We are understandably weary, and some are unwilling to change, to do anything more than to merely survive. But change we must. It must never be forgotten that some of our ancestors preferred the bare survival of slavery to the possibilities of freedom. The question is, what is the road to prosperity? We hope to answer this query in the next Black Acre blog. Leo Baron Hicks, founder and CEO of Black Acre Policy Forum. Leo, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
It is always, always a pleasure to have you here, and I have to start again by, again, another great piece of work, man. I mean, your writing is amazing. Again, I say you are the ninja of writing about this, and so I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks, and I really appreciate your support. And I tell you, man, your show is getting better and better. I heard the thing with Reverend Al Sharpton, and I also heard the rap ditty with the introduction to Black Acre, and I got to say, I like it.
Oh, awesome, awesome. I really appreciate that. Certainly want this part of the show to be highlighted in every way that I can, because, again, the quality of the work is just amazing. And so, again, what made you write this today? I mean, give me the backstory of this particular blog.
Well, the opening paragraphs to the blog are true life. I've got a good friend that I work with, and his name is not Jefferson. His name is something else. But he is one of the sharpest brothers that I have ever seen in my life. I mean, there is nothing that this brother can't do. Yet he, like many of us, are stuck on this rusty nail where we're not happy with our situation. And we complain about it, but we're not doing anything to change our situation. And I think that's true of many African Americans. And I just don't want us to confuse barely surviving with success, because I think many of us do.
I think that's a great point. But what do you say to the barriers out there for people that won't allow them to really take that next step? Here's what I mean by that. Being in a good job, barely making it, we all have certain things we don't like about a job, but there are some instances, as you pointed out, that people really hate their jobs. I mean, hate it with a passion. But the job market for African Americans are twice as much as it is for most majority Americans. The market itself is really hard to be able to go out and get certain loans. There's also challenges with just dropping what you're doing because you have existing responsibilities. So how does one come out of that situation to be able to take that leap of faith and not necessarily and get off the rusty nail, basically?
Well, I don't pretend that doing something about your situation is easy. And I'm the last person who thinks that I know everything, because clearly I don't. But the difficulties you talked about, for me, aren't reasons not to try to do better. They are just the opposite, reasons why you must try to do better. And the path may be different for you than it is for me. But again, our ancestors faced an even more perilous journey from slavery to freedom, yet they took that journey. But for that, you and I wouldn't be in the position to have our own think tanks or radio shows. And since we stand on the shoulders of others, if we don't take that journey to better our situation, if we don't realize that there is a real and material difference between barely surviving and prospering, on whose shoulders will future generations stand?
Yeah, I that's a great point. I mean, the fact that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, and then if we don't continue to take risk or to put ourselves in a position, then what does our future look like? I mean, right now in our current state, do you see any advantages of our future generations, or is anything that they can potentially benefit from, like we've benefited from our previous generation?
Well, I don't know. I can tell you this. Previous generations demanded education. I know my family were teachers, and they demanded that I not bring home C's, because when you bring home C's, you're merely surviving. They required me to thrive, and I used to get my butt whooped for bringing home C's. So if I didn't bring home a B or better, I had to deal with my old man, and I did not want to deal with my old man. That's what I mean by barely survival isn't enough. Our duty is to soar with the clouds, not to crawl on the ground. And I just don't want us to think that survival equal success, because it does not.
Outstanding. Jim, you want to weigh in here? I heard you kind of agreeing with Leo's comment.
I do. I agree with that in terms of, the value that was placed on education in our time as opposed to what it is now. I mean, you have people who will go through, their children will go through a whole year and there's no checking of homework, there's no checking of grades, and yet, we wonder why our kids get to a certain point and they can't read. Well, who's checking to see and who's reading with them at home? And so I think Leo's right in terms of we have to do more than just survive. It's, surviving because you're always in the, you're in a constant rat race when you do it that way. And at some point, I'm sure when they made it out, they wasn't, you know, they wanted to enjoy that moment. They didn't continue to try to struggle. You know, at some point, you want to enjoy the fruits of your labor. And if all you're doing is surviving, you never really get to enjoy what it is that you're trying to obtain. So I get that.
So, Leah, what are some of the, I'm going to say, the psychological or the mental barriers then that keep people kind of in bondage that way? I mean, because obviously this is America, right? We all have those same opportunities. What's preventing us from doing that?
Well, I think there are two big psychological barriers. Number one is fear. At some point, even though you're miserable, you grow comfortable with that misery because you can deal with it. You're not happy, but you can deal with it. And to get off that rusty nail means that you have to deal with new things and new challenges, and sometimes that's fearful, i.e. better the devil I know than the devil I don't know, but it's still the devil. So I think fear is one of the things, fear of failure as well as fear of success, because if I'm successful, that brings a whole new slew of problems that I have to deal with. Then I don't have any excuse. If I'm just surviving, I can blame my plight on someone else. But once I get off that rusty nail, then I can't blame anybody else but me. And some of us simply don't want to look in the mirror. We don't want that responsibility. And I think another psychological barrier is fatigue. It takes so much to survive that at the end of the day, you are just so beat down. The only thing you want to do is go home, have some comfort food, look at TV, and decompress. So I think those are two real big barriers.
You know, that I'm reminded of a poem by Marianne Williamson that says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure, you know. And so to talk about the fact that, you know, we're fearful of being successful, I think has a lot of merit. And in fact, when it comes to being successful, you have to be responsible at some point. And so not only have you had to be fearful of having success, but you also now have to be responsible to deal with that. And so I think that's a really good point. You know, I wonder, though, when we talk about especially the African-American culture, because I think that's the context of what we're talking about here, is that when you have people, and we had a segment earlier and we talked about Kevin Hart donated $50,000 to Texas Southern University, which is one of the HBCUs, but we also hear so many of the HBCUs going under. Do you think it's kind of incumbent upon the people that have been successful to reach back and to help guide others so they can, A, you know, help maybe curtail some of the fear, not necessarily get rid of it, and to also maybe to provide a springboard and so that we can begin to, you know, that's the responsibility piece. What do you think about that, Leo?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I and you and your wife and Reverend Sharp and all of us who supposedly have made it clearly have an obligation to reach back. However, there is a concordant obligation for those whom we are helping to reach up, to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean by survival isn't enough. If I'm on the street and I'm just barely making it, and I got my food and all, and I got my car and whatever I have, that's fine. But when somebody like you or Jima say, well, look, let me reach back and help you achieve more, then I am obligated to reach up and say, okay, mentor me. What do I have to do to improve my situation, not only for me but for those I love?
I think that's an absolutely great point. Jim, you have any comment?
I agree with that 112,000%, because I think that's where we lose the process, if there's no expectation for the one that's receiving to do in kind and to give back, then they're not going to do it. And so, you know, we have to sometimes tell people in some kind of way to remind them, you know, remember how someone, you know, helped you, so that that young man that sees an older man opening the door for a woman may one day decide, I need to open that door too. And, that's mentoring, even if you never knew the person. If they see you with a book, or you're talking about certain things, and at some point you're going to pique their interest where they might start talking about that. And then you find out they brought something up at school one day based on what they saw you do or heard you say. And so I think that's important that we do. I love that, Leo. I love that. Those of us that reach back, you know, we do that, but those that we reach back to should then reach up to receive what it is we're trying to give. I like that. That's really good.
Well, thanks. I mean, I've got a brother whom I love dearly, and God knows he's had some difficulties, like we all have, because we're all products of pain. But if you're on welfare, for example, and welfare is giving you enough money that, you know, you got a place to live, or if you're a day laborer and, you know, you every now and then you get a job and you got a place to live, that's barely surviving. But that's not being successful. That is not prospering. Because at some point, if you're a day laborer, you're going to get old and you don't have any retirement and you don't have any benefits and you don't have any future. We can't be satisfied just with surviving slavery and discrimination. We are obligated to do better. And that was the very heart and soul of that particular blog.
Well, Leo, as always, man, I mean, it was a great piece, and again, I always look forward to having this conversation, because I think, you know, we go every day in our society, and sometimes these things go without saying, right? I mean, it's good to be able to have this part communicated and then talked about in a forum where there's no it's a safe environment, and you got to worry about people cussing and slanging and getting upset. I mean, here are the facts, right? And then offer solutions, right? It's not about, you know, again, coming up with having another meeting just to have a meeting. Here's some real hardcore innovative solutions to get out and do, and the fact that we're doing them every day ourselves. So, again, great piece, man, and I just love you like a brother, man, from another mother, man. You are just awesome.
Hey, man, thank you, and I want to make an announcement, too. Mm-hmm. Today I went to church.
What?
Yeah, I know that's a shock.
but
today I went to church, and I got to tell you, I left church less than a cynic than when I went.
Oh. Mm.
That's progress.
That's powerful.
It's something, you know. But I was up in there. And you know, it's like, okay, I get it. I understand why people are here. So I just thought you might want to know that.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that, man. That is awesome. All right, Leo,
thank
man.
You.
It's always a pleasure, man. All right. Talk
hey,
to you
man.
Later.
Ditto. I love you too, man.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break when we return with a couple of the issues, just like we always do. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com. And click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Boone friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, I want to get to, we only got a couple more segments before the show, and I think we're going to try to cover the BET Awards because they're coming on tonight, and I definitely want to kind of talk about those. But I want to go to an issue out of North Carolina that I think, that is very important. And so I'm going to play a part here that was on Chris Hayes' show, and I want you to take a listen to this, and we're gonna discuss this for a moment. Take a listen.
Monday, June 30th is the final deadline for some of the state's residents to apply for reparations from the state of North Carolina. Our final report in this week's All in America Behind the Color Line series explains just what the state is hoping to compensate for.
You're playing God over a whole group of people's lives, and I don't think we're supposed to play God like that.
How does a state begin to make amends for the wrongs it committed against its own people?
The money is fine. The money is fine. But still ain't gonna bring anything back.
This is a story about a government paying the people it's harmed in the United States, in the South, in a state controlled by Republicans.
I thought it was a simple matter of justice. They had been physically harmed, emotionally harmed, and never been compensated.
In the context of America's torturous racial history, reparations is a third rail, one of the most polarizing concepts in all of American politics. They've been dismissed over time as impractical, impossible.
The excuses for not giving reparations today were the same excuses when the slaves were alive. The excuses have not changed. Our, you know, strategy is to run out the clock. The clock is the same then. It's the same today.
In 1933, North Carolina created the Eugenics Board, tasked with sterilizing mentally diseased or feeble-minded people. Its business was every bit as ugly as its name suggests.
Find some people that I didn't know, that I didn't know what I was finding.
John Rayleigh of the Winston-Salem Journal has been investigating the program over a decade.
The North Carolina Eugenics Board for 45 years ran one of the most aggressive forced sterilization programs in the country.
Pamphlets encouraging the practice of sterilization warned the mentally defective are entrusted with the most important and far-reaching job of all, parenthood.
It went for epileptics, it went for blind people, it went for deaf people. And, you know, often it was just based on gossip. It went for promiscuous people. It was just out of control.
By 1974, an estimated 7,600 men and women, by force or manipulation, were sterilized by the state of North Carolina. Janice Black was one of those people. She now lives with her friend and legal guardian, Sadie Gilmore Long.
Oh, I don't really want that. And I was in the hospital. And when I woke up, I was all bandaged up in the waist down.
In 1971, the state eugenics board agreed that Janice Black was an exploitable individual due to her low IQ. She was sterilized at the age of 18.
Well, I fixed something that I just couldn't put my finger on it right there. I couldn't put my finger on it right there. So they didn't tell me what I was going for.
The state's efforts were not explicitly racially targeted, but the effects were disproportionate. After World War II, 40% of those sterilized were non-white, while just about 26% of the state's population at the time was non-white.
In the 1950s and 1960s, even as North Carolina was gaining this reputation for peaceful integration as a southern state, it begins to target African-American girls and women, often who'd had children out of wedlock and were of modest means, often on welfare. So it became a means of trimming the welfare rolls.
The eugenics board was formally shut down in 1977, but it wasn't until 2002 that the state officially apologized for what it did. A decade later, Democratic Governor Bev Perdue pushed to compensate survivors. After bipartisan efforts, the historic proposal died.
Senate Republicans could not even agree on a dollar amount, or even if North Carolina should open the door to what many of them describe as righting a wrong.
Last year, a new, more modest proposal was championed by Republican Governor Pat McCrory and championed by current Senate candidate, then State Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis. Republican State Representative Paul Skip Stamm co-sponsored the bill.
We'd apologized to them. We had repealed the program, but those only go so far.
This year, North Carolina will become the first state in the nation to compensate victims of forced sterilization, with a $10 million fund set aside. But the same Republicans who helped fund this historic reparations program don't want it called a reparations program.
Reparations down here in North Carolina typically means the descendants of one group paying the descendants of another group. This is not reaching back into history to right a wrong that's purely history. We're trying to right a wrong that is still alive in people's minds and bodies.
God our Father, we bless you today.
Critics, like North Carolina NAACP President Reverend Barber, see contradictions in the effort.
How are you for correcting or doing something in part to correct the eugenics 50 years ago, but now you're cutting health care today? there's this dichotomy that doesn't make sense here. But what we said to Democrats and Republicans, we need to do more than just give them some money.
The deadline to apply for the program is June 30th. An estimated 1,800 survivors are still alive, but as of now, only 630 of them have filed claims, and only 465 of those claims are being processed.
Do you think it makes sense to have a deadline?
The idea that there should be like a deadline for doing the right thing. Like, I'll do right by you up until, you know, this point, and then I'll, you know, cease to, you know, we have to call it quits. It's not so much reparations as it is hush money.
Next year, the state of North Carolina will be cutting checks. But justice, well, that's another matter.
Coming up, I'll talk to one of my MSNBC colleagues who's been on the ground doing reporting in North Carolina on this story, along with someone who is representing sterilization victims. Stay with us.
So, as this story suggested here, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but yeah, there was a eugenics board that was established, and their purpose was to stop people from having kids. And they would go out initially and pick people that had some type of ailment or disability. And it kind of bubbled over into people that they considered to be that couldn't read or illegitimate or had some type of deficiency. Now, that's interesting in itself, because one would think today, in today's society, that truly was somebody that probably didn't have the means. But remember all the issues around voting and how, you know, how these gimmicks were in place to stop people from voting, and poll taxes were in place. And so, you know, just because it was defined a certain way doesn't mean it was implemented in that way, meaning that it was a lot of hearsay. I think that that person is an imbecile. And I'm going to, you know, in essence, just castrate them or do something to them to prevent them from having children. And I guess what's more staggering or shocking to me is the fact that it only stopped in 1977, which means in my generation's lifetime, this was still being implemented. Had I been, my parents been, you know, natives of North Carolina, it could have impacted me or my sister or my brother in such a way that we wouldn't even be here or you wouldn't be listening to me today. This was just in 1977. So, you know, I was, you know, very young, you know, a couple of years old at that time. The fact that it was still happening, taking place during that time, is staggering. And then the apology that happened in 2002 was issued. And then in 2012, the state legislature put in, you know, some measures to try to compensate the people that were affected by it, and then it failed. And it was brought back last year, and then ultimately it looks like it's going to be going forward. But this is what's some disturbing news to me, to know that this was taking place. And, you know, we also talk about the fact that the Voting Rights Act and the fact that, you know, slavery and these things, as if they were a distant past. But, you know, we're talking, you know, not that long ago, a couple of generations ago, you know, that these things were taking place in the United States. And so, Jima, you know, I want to bring you in on this now. What do you think about this particular issue with respect to sterilizing people, the eugenics board, and the fact that they're still having difficulty trying to compensate the people for this issue?
Well, the unfortunate part is that there's really no amount of compensation, reparations, whatever Asian's term we want to use, that will mend the hearts and souls of those people that were violated and whose rights were taken away from them unbeknownst to them. And it's sad and unfortunate that, as you stated, that this was happening, you know, during our lifetime, not something that happened 100 years ago, but we're talking the 70s is when it stopped, and here we are in 2014, and they're just now wanting to say they were wrong about it and wanting to do something about it. That's the sad part about it. The sad part is that they still won't admit to how wrong this was and how illegal this was and how immoral this was that they did this, and that, and yet we try to position ourselves as America to be the moral compass for the world, and yet we on a daily basis, a yearly basis, a decade basis, continue to allow such atrocities to happen here on these great American soil. So it bothers me that in listening to their stories, and I remember this from a couple of years ago when it first became a newsworthy, just their stories of the people whose lives, who had died waiting for something to be done, waiting for the state to say they were wrong, and then they never got to hear it, who was denied having another child, and whose child they did have ended up dying, but they couldn't have any more. You know, say those types of stories, and who made them the
God, basically.
Of,
yeah.
Right, yeah. They
playing
right,
God, like the guy said, playing
right,
God.
Hmm? Right, of somebody else's womb. Who gave you that right? And so, you know, that's what kind of rubs me, and I have to, you know, stay prayed up when I hear these types of stories, because I get angry at America all over again for the hypocrisy that she displays on so many levels. And so this is just yet another one of those, as the Reverend Barbara said, levels of hypocrisy. Because on the one hand, you're trying to, you're regulating people's reproductive areas, and then on the other hand, you're telling them we're not going to provide you with any health care because you don't even want to expand Medicaid. I mean, you can't look at what's happening and what has happened and not try and not correlate it with things that are going on right now. And then the fact that they're trying to parcel it out and not want to call it reparations, you know, I don't really care what you call it. You know, call it wrong first. How about that? How about the acknowledgement?
That's profound. That's profound right there.
You know, call it that. And then how do you put a deadline on people to come forward about something? And in the state in which you live in the rural areas that were primarily affected by this, how are those people going to even know that they missed the deadline? I mean, why even have a deadline? You know, what makes that okay? And so, it's just so much. It's so much to unpack, and it's heart wrenching to hear the stories, and then, you know, you want to get on TV and talk to me about impeaching the president. I don't understand.
Exactly right. Suing the president for something that's
right.
That's so crazy, you know. But I'm really going to look into the issue of what does it take to sue the Congress, right? I mean, if John Boehner can go out on a limb and say he wants to sue the president, so either there's precedence for it or there's some rationale that one must be able to do in order to do that. And you know, who knows? I mean, because if there's a way to be able to bring to at least hold them accountable in some way, you know, even if it's a civil lawsuit, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out since he opened the door for it, you know. And when you look at the fact that, you know, there's a lot of issues that are going on in the United States and they have not addressed it. Even if you don't do something that I like, you do something, you know what I'm saying? So, but doing nothing is unacceptable. And so, yeah, and then to put a deadline on these people, it is just so sad that, you know, the people that we put in charge, that we vote in, that's supposed to have, you know, be in the best interest of the American people, end up treating people like this. It's just sad. So I want to shift now to the BET Awards. I want to shift to a lighter note as we get ready to close here in our last couple of seconds. What do you think about the BET Awards? You think it's going to be pretty good tonight?
I think so. I think Chris Rock is going to do what he does. All the lead-up commercials with him and Kevin Hart and all the people that are going to be on there. I love Lionel Richie. I've been a Lionel Richie fan my entire life. So I love the fact that he's getting a BET Lifetime Achievement Award. So that's going to bring somebody out on stage to do the tribute. BET is good for bringing groups back together that you haven't seen perform in a long time. So I'm looking forward to who that might be for this. Who's that one group that's going to come back out? And so I'm excited about that. I'm not a big Beyonce fan or Jay-Z fan. I mean, I like them, but, you know, I'm not going to stop breathing because they're going to be there, but they're going to be there. Jennifer Hudson is going to be performing, John Legend. They got all the heavy hitters, it seems like. And so I'm anticipating, I think the red carpet has already started, and I'm anticipating that it's going to be, they said this is usually the highest rated show on cable award show because it really does speak to the entertainers and the people in the music and not the people that's doing the presenting. And so I saw Kerry Washington is going to be on there, and so it's probably going to be a big night in entertainment for things that are on an entertainment scale relevant to African Americans on the eve of going down to the Essence Festival for, you know, next weekend, being 4th of July weekend, the 20th anniversary of Essence Festival, with Prince being there. That is oh my gosh, major.
Don't remind me.
And so, right. And so, so this is a good, and it closes out Black Music Month. You know, June is Black Music Month, and so it closes that out. And so it's good. It's good. I think it's going to be good. I think Chris Rock is going to bring his A game, because you can't not have your A game in front of people of color, because you would never recover.
That's a true statement. Yeah. So
I'm sure he's going to. Yeah.
So there's already a dark shadow over the BET Awards. We haven't even got started really yet, but it's been reported now that by the AP, which is a pretty much credible news source, that a fatal shooting and a separate stabbing at a couple of unsanctioned parties celebrating the BET Awards, where top superstars like Lil Wayne, Chris Rock, and others were set to mark the best on the stage tonight, but one person was killed and five injured in two separate incidents ahead of the show at the Nokia Theater, LA Live, Los Angeles police said. The events were unauthorized and unaffiliated with the BET Awards, but quite naturally, because of the celebrities that were in attendance, you know, it's going to cast a dark shadow over the BET Awards. Or even if it was some locals that got into you know, you're going to hear reports about making an association. And the association will be primarily associated with the fact that the BET Awards was the most viewed show last year this time on TV, period. And so when you have that type of ratings and that type of notoriety, quite naturally, especially, and then I hate to say this, but especially because it's associated with African-Americans primarily, then you're going to have anything negative be highlighted probably more so than not. Now, granted, now you can't go out and do these things, right? I mean, it is not the media making this story. It is the people out there making this story. But you also have to make sure that you understand that it will be spend in such a way that it's going to be a direct correlation to the BET Awards, whether it was or not. And so I just wanted to point that out as you start to see reports coming in about this in the next coming minutes and hours to come. Yeah. So as we get ready to wrap up, what are your final thoughts? And by the way, great work over the last couple of weeks with the summer program. We've serviced you know, almost upward of 50 kids over the past couple of weeks, and it has been a certainly absolute challenge and joy to be there. But I think we're providing a great service, and I wanted to get your input about the program.
Yes, we're averaging about, like you stated, anywhere between 40 to 50 kids a day. Age range from 4 up to 17, 18 years old, and the challenge is keeping them busy and occupied and doing something. It's amazing that they, you know, the kids are a different breed, and I've worked around juveniles for over 20 some odd years now, and every year the summer program teaches me something different about a deficiency that's in our kids. And this year I'm recognizing that there's some issues with self-esteem. There's some issues with a desire to fit in and to be a part of. And then there's some real issues with language. By language, I mean reading and reading comprehension. And so that's where I see us needing to have the greatest impact this year, is in making sure that the people, the young people, are feeling good about themselves, and that they embrace who they are, and that the things that they want to change, that they change them because they want to, not because someone has made fun of them or not because someone has said something about them or anything like that. So finding a way to mesh the two together, not only do we provide that piece of it, but we provide the spiritual piece of it. We open every day with a devotional and a lesson, and I encourage them. And they're listening because I ask questions, and they can answer the questions that I'm asking as it related to the story. So I'm encouraged by that. It can be overwhelming. As, you know, I think Scripture talks about, you know, there's a lot of work, but we don't have a lot of workers. And so, you know, that's true with where we sit right now. There's always room for more laborers to come and assist. And so I just, you know, I'm looking forward. We're down 2 weeks, and we have 4 weeks to go. And this week is a shortened week because of the holiday. And so I'm anticipating coming back next week with my cup full that will sustain me through the rest of the program. But it's been a joy. It has been a joy.
Awesome, awesome. All right, any final thoughts?
My final thoughts is all those that's listening in Kansas City area, I will be having a book signing. I'm going to confirm the location, but I will be having a book signing, so stay tuned. Look on my Facebook page, Reflections, What I Know to Be True, and I will be able to give you that information. But I will be in Kansas City this weekend, and I will be having another book signing there, so I'm excited about that.
All right, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. And don't forget to visit her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's J-E-M-A. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. Now remember to visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMade TalkRadio.blogspot.com. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.